14. A sea of black ice flowed under the lander as it traversed the shelf. Perry dozed again, his head lolling against the window. Svetlana followed his lead and power-napped for 10 dreamless minutes. When she came to, the lander was on final approach for Crabtree, Anglis making the same unforgiving economies with fuel. Svetlana thought about the easy promises she had given Ramos, all the fuel and machine she needed, and 12 strong workers, as if it was ever going to be that easy. Lesson 1 on Janus. Nothing was easy. The lander made a descending curve around the central tower that had once been Rockhopper. 900 meters of the ship projected above the foundation well Parry and his team had punched into the Janus ice. They had buried the ship stern down, with the engine, reactor assembly and fuel tanks completely underground, just like plugging a mass driver into a comet, Denise Nadis had said. All that was visible now was the spine and the top-heavy bulge of the habitat section. Tether lines splayed out from the hab in 4 directions, anchored to the ice with spray rock embedded pitons beyond the loose perimeter of the surface community. The ship was never going anywhere again. No one even thought of it as a ship anymore. Rockhopper was just the central tower of Crabtree, its administrative core and power station. It was a resource to be stripped and remade for the good of the community. Of the 141 people on Janus, most now chose to dwell outside Rockhopper. 30 domes spread away from the base of the ship, linked by underground tunnels and pressurized surface corridors. Ice had been lathered up over the sides of the domes to provide additional insulation, lending them the look of half-melted igloos. Most of the domes were just large enough for a single family-sized unit, 3 or 4 people at most. The domes closest to the ship had been put down first. Parry's EVA team had used them during the initial cometary operations. Those further out were improvised structures, lashed together using metals and composites, scavenged from Rockhopper, with offcuts of parasol foil providing the basic pressure-containing envelope. Spray rock was a quicker building medium, but like everything else, it had to be used sparingly now. Between the domes lurked equipment modules, generators, and storage shacks. A scattering of pale yellow window lights hinted at human presence. Blackouts were enforced during long hours of each day. Svetlana would gladly have extended the duration of the power outages, but she was concerned about spreading panic. The lander bumped to ground beyond the edge of Crabtree. They disembarked and boarded a wire-wheeled tractor that had been waiting at the edge of the apron. Anglis took the tractor's controls and drove it along a furrowed, slipshod road that cut between the tents and their snaking connections. Crabtree was still only a hamlet, but at times it felt as if it was poised to become something larger. If the deaths slowed and the births continued, then within 10 years, by the time they arrived at Spiker... But Svetlana closed the book on those thoughts. She did not hold out any hope that Janus could be slowed, let alone reversed, but unless their current fortunes improved, they could not count on surviving until they reached Spiker either. She kept having to remind herself that it was not October 2059. It was some other date that she did not want to think about. 2059 was just a lie they told themselves to stay sane, to comfort themselves that they had not already drifted too far upstream ever to return home. It was the one piece of advice Svetlana had accepted from her before the exile. Honor the old calendar. Make a day count as a day, even as their increasing speed squeezed time until it bled. 2 months after Rockhopper's entry into the Janus slipstream, the moon had reached a speed that was slower than light by only 0.1%. Janus had stopped accelerating once it reached that speed, but it was still harrowingly fast. Relativity dictated that clocks ran 22 times slower on Janus than they did on Earth. Not just clocks either, but every measurable physical and biological process, including time itself. In the hour that had passed since she had said goodbye to Ramos, nearly a full day had elapsed on Earth. Janus had been at cruise speed for 22 months, as measured by Rockhopper time. On Earth, 40 years had passed. It was somewhere near the closing years of the 21st century. If by some unlikely good fortune they were to succeed in turning around now, 80 years would have elapsed by the time they made it back home. It would be nearly 21:37. Not everyone accepted this. With its antennae pointed back home, Crabtree was still intercepting radio signals originating from Earth. The messages were redshifted towards ultra-long wavelengths, but information could still be gleaned from them, and according to the messages, it was still only 20:59. They heard news from families, loved ones, friends, but a little less with each week that passed. The world they'd left behind spun on, half-familiar news stories still dominating the headlines, the same celebrities, the same scandals and tragedies. For a little while, the plight of Rockhopper and its crew had even been one of those objects of global attention, until something quietly displaced it and they faded into the back pages. The messages were dangerous and comforting in equal measure. They told a lie, but only because they were bound to the same universal speed limit as Janus. Messages from 2097, or even 2137, would not catch up with Janus before it reached Spiker. They would never learn the history of the world they had left behind. Not until they turned for home, at which point they'd be flying headlong into that blizzard of information. The years would crash forward. 80 years of history crammed into the 2 years of their return flight, even if they succeeded in turning around now. And if they did not begin their return journey until after Janus reached Spiker, they would have to recapitulate 520 years of history. That was too much to take in, so they used the old calendar and pretended that every day that passed on Janus had the same measure as a day on Earth. It gave their lives some structure. They celebrated birthdays, holidays, and festivals. They still talked of summer and winter, and made some effort to mark these seasonal changes in the way that the blackouts and brownouts were imposed on Crabtree's electrical supply. Svetlana had done all that she could to make the last summer a little better, a little more tolerable than the grim winter that had preceded it. But now it was winter again, and the fuel tanks were running perilously low. Above the settlement, a huddle of blood-red stars crowded the zenith directly over Crabtree's central tower. There were no stars at all anywhere else in the visible hemisphere of sky. They had been torn from their fixed positions by the iron hand of relativity. Most stars were red to begin with, so the Doppler effect only made them redder. On the bow side of Janus there was another, brighter huddle, where starlight had been shifted ferociously into the blue. It was as beautiful as it was lethal. Bracelet dosages went through the roof as blue-shifted cosmic rays sliced flesh and cell. The electric tractor bumbled down an ice-walled ramp into one of the equipment bays dug out around the base of the downed ship. They disembarked, passed through another airlock, and were helped out of their suits by a beaming Kunj Ramasesha. Like Ramos, Ramasesha had made the transition to Janus life with relatively little difficulty. The suit technicians, not just Ramasesha, but Ash Murray and Rekka Bettendorf, were vital to the functioning of the new colony, and they reveled in their new sense of civic importance, guarding their expertise with the zealotry of a medieval guild. Svetlana and Parry bade farewell to Unglis and rode a car up the spine to the Hab. Although the Janus machinery gave off its own glow, none of it reached Crabtree. The ice around the little community was as dark as space, lent only the faintest midnight sheen by the cluster of red-shifted stars in the stern hemisphere. A few transponders winked out of the darkness like distant lighthouse beacons. As the car rose higher, Crabtree looked like the only human artifact in the universe. Svetlana had timed her return well. She was only a minute late for the meeting with the other members of the interim authority. They had assembled in what had once been the captain's office and private quarters. The cramped old room was twice as large now. Internal partitions had been torn down throughout Rockhopper, the material used elsewhere. The old carpet no longer met the walls, but it remained the focus of the room. Even the fish tank was still there, and there were even some fish in it. Some parts of the old ship were routinely spun to provide centrifugal gravity. Axford insisted on having such a facility, since calcium loss was a real concern under the weak pull of Janus, but this was not one of them. The fish did not appear to mind too much. Ryan Axford was present, along with Saul Regis, Nick Thale, Denise Nadis, Jake Gomberg, and Christine Ofria. Like Axford, Regis, and Thale had both been old regime loyalists, but but their expertise was too essential to ignore. Sometimes there was tension between the three of them and the rest of the authority, but they were usually pragmatic enough to put such things aside if it helped Crabtree. Svetlana and Parry took their places around the table, moving with the effortless glides that characterized locomotion on Janus. Svetlana lowered herself into her seat, folded her hands on the table before her and nodded briefly at the other members. "I've just returned from the moor," she began, "and for once it looks as if we might have discovered something that could almost be described as good news. To put that into the proper context, though, I must emphasize how truly shitty things really are. Parry, will you do the honors?" Parry removed his cap and scratched a finger into his mustache. "I won't even attempt to put a positive spin on any of this, and I'm sure it'll come as no surprise to any of you that fuel is our main problem. Before we landed on Janus, we had high expectations of tapping the moon's energy for our own uses. That was a nice idea, but it hasn't turned out to be so simple in practice. The Spiken machinery is hellishly efficient. It doesn't give off a lot of waste energy for us to exploit. The only area where we've had much luck is with the thermoelectric generators. They exploit the heat difference between the Spiken machinery and the ice cap. But the heat difference isn't huge, and we don't have enough superconducting cable to run any more lines out to the edge of the ice cap. If we were going back to square one now, we might choose a different landing site, closer to the shelf. But since we don't have a time machine..." Nadis tapped a stylus against her flexi. "How much power are we getting now?" "From the thermocouples, depending on fluctuations in the machinery, anything between 3 to 5 megawatts, which isn't enough to run Crabtree. We're fine at the moment because we can still run the fusion engine. We're easily extracting 100 megawatts, but it isn't efficient. Lockheed Khrunichev built that engine to move Rockhopper around, not light up a village. We waste far more energy than we extract." "The fuel won't last more than 14 months, Svetlana said bluntly. 18 if we eke it out with even more power outages and shut down some of the outlying domes. We might as well stop rationing the coffee in that case, Nadis said. There's no hope of squeezing more power from the thermocouples, Thale asked. Even if we get the forge vat running and scrape together the raw materials and power to spin out more superconducting line, we'd only be looking at doubling our capacity from the thermocouples, Svetlana said, which won't even get us through to next summer. We'll still be relying on the fusion engine. Parry cleared his throat. We've been looking at other options. Heat isn't the only thing Janus has to offer us. As most of you probably know, we've had a team looking into the possibility of extracting power from the lava lines, either directly or by tapping the motion of the transits. So far we've had no success, but it is a possibility for the future. We just have to stick around long enough to get there. Hence this meeting, Svetlana said. 2 weeks ago, we learned something significant about one of the structures in the moor chamber. It's rotating. It's slow, almost too slow to notice, but it's regular and it appears to have immeasurably high torque. If we can tap that motion, there is every chance that we'll be able to turn off the fusion reactor and save the remaining fuel for the day when we really need it. Svetlana let the little party absorb that glimmer of good news. It was all they were going to get from her. Okay, she said after a few moments. Now for the hard part. Actually doing it, and doing it before we all die anyway. It isn't going to be easy, but we think we have a roadmap. There are two difficult parts to this operation, Parry said. The first is tapping that rotational motion and converting it into electrical power. The second is getting that power out of the moor and back to Crabtree. The first part is where most of the headaches are going to arise. Problem number one is that the spire, the rotating structure, is turning very, very slowly. But we think we can deal with that. Svetlana called up a diagram on her flexi and projected it onto the wall behind her. She leaned back in her seat, twisting her neck to take it all in. It was a crudely drawn sketch of the spire in the moor chamber, with something approximating a set of gear teeth fixed around its base. "We'll begin by attaching cogs all around the structure," she said. "They're basically just chunks of machined metal. We know glue works, and we know what kind of torques the adhesive bonds can tolerate before they fail. Ramos and the others say it can be done. That gives us a system for coupling a second smaller wheel to the spire's rotation. That wheel will turn faster. But still not fast enough, Parry said. We're going to have to lash up loads of these things. A clockwork gear train like nothing you've seen since the 16th century. We're going to need a gear ratio up in the millions. There were exasperated sounds, but Parry pushed on. We'll strip out one of Rockhopper's main centrifuge rings and the associated drive system. That should give us the building blocks, or at least enough to make a start. Whatever we come up with, it'll have to work flawlessly, and at the end of it we'll need an output shaft turning at around 100 hertz, to which we can couple as many industrial capacity dynamos as we can put our hands on, Svetlana said. I expect there are some lying around here somewhere, Nick Thale said, his voice dripping sarcasm. There are, Parry said firmly. We used them every time we pushed ice. Thale's eyes narrowed. Mass drivers. I don't see how linear... The parasol spinners, said Nadis, nodding appreciatively. For the apparent benefit of Thale and Regis, she added, the electric motors were used to spin up the sun-shared parasols to shield the dayside of the comet during the infall cruise. That's the idea, Svetlana said, nodding approvingly. We reverse them. Use them as dynamos instead of motors. We'll have to beef up some of the components, but I'm told it's workable. If we can solve the drive shaft problem, we can tap 15 to 20 megawatts. That'll free us from any further dependency on Rockhopper's fuel. But only if we can convey that power to Crabtree. For that, we'll need about 4 times our current mileage of superconducting cable. Then it's hopeless, Nadis said, exasperated. We can't even fix the existing cables, let alone make more of them. Not yet, Svetlana said. But if we can get the forge vat running, we can spin out all the cable we'll ever need. Have you spoken to Wang lately? Svetlana did not care for the tone of the other woman's voice. Not for a few weeks, she said defensively. The last I heard, he was making good progress. Maybe you should visit him one of these days, Nadis said. I think you'll find it illuminating. I will, Svetlana said, annoyed with herself for not having kept a closer watch on Wang's stumbling progress. As soon as we're done here, assuming we can get the vat up to speed, I take it everything I've proposed here has the committee's approval? It's not as if we have much choice, Parry said. If we don't tap Janus, we're finished within a year and a half. I agree that it looks clear-cut, Thale said, but let's not underestimate the risks. So far we've barely scratched Janus. Sometimes I wonder if it's even noticed us yet. But if we start interfering in more obvious ways... We have no choice, Svetlana said. I'm just saying, there may be consequences. Thale looked at the others, inviting support. We shouldn't kid ourselves that this is a risk-free strategy. We all grasp the risks, Svetlana said impatiently. But whatever we do in the moor will be nowhere near as risky as sitting here hoping for something else to drop into our laps. Thale closed his eyes. I'm just saying, he began again, before shaking his head. Never mind, you wouldn't go for it anyway. Svetlana sensed a trap, but spoke anyway. Go for what? This is too big a decision to be left to a handful of people sitting around a table. You mean we should poll the rest? No, not that. He spoke with infinite caution, as if every word might trigger the most devastating of reactions. I mean we should consider bringing other opinions into the debate. I'm talking about Wang, of course, and perhaps one or two others, but mainly I mean her. No, Svetlana said. You won't even consider it? No, she repeated. Not now, not ever. Thale shrugged, as if this was no more and no less than he had expected. He sank back into his seat. Fine, then. Svetlana felt a hot blush sear her cheeks. She was grateful when Parry filled the silence, sparing her the duty. We've been over this, Nick, he said. We all know that some of us felt more loyalty to her than others. But that was then. Everything is different now. Her opinions just don't have any further relevance. You'd love to believe that, Thale said. You'd love to believe that we can just put her in a box and forget about her, like an old toy we don't want to play with anymore. She had her chance to turn us around, Parry said. Instead, she dragged us into this mess. She acted on the best information available to her, Thales said. Nick's right, Axford said. Nothing Bella did was motivated by greed or self-interest. She only ever did what she thought was best for her crew. She couldn't face the idea that Deep Shaft was screwing us, Svetlana said. I gave her all the evidence she needed, and she blanked on it. She thumped the table with her fist. Why the hell are we still talking about this? We've been over it 1,000 times. She had her chance. She blew it. End of story. Look, Parry said, talking directly to Axford. I agree completely that Bella didn't act out of self-interest. No argument there. Fine, Axford said briskly. But she still made bad decisions. Maybe her heart was in the right place. So what? It was the decisions that mattered. That alone should disqualify her from having any further say in our affairs. You just don't get it, Thales said. No, Nick, Svetlana answered. You don't get it. We all know where your basic loyalties lie. You just can't let it go, can you? You just can't accept that things are different around here now. Maybe it isn't me who has trouble letting go of the past, Thales said. Meaning what, exactly? Svetlana said, her voice low and dangerously sweet. When we grounded Rockhopper, you made a big speech about how we all had to pull together, how we had to heal old wounds and face the future with clear hearts, clear minds. I remember it well. It was a damned effective piece of sloganeering. Careful, Nick, she said. He shrugged and continued speaking. I remember one other thing you said about how we had to use every resource available to us, every possible means of staying alive. Well, some of us listened to you. Some of us thought you meant it. I did, she said, on the boiling edge of fury. Perhaps that's true up to a point, but there's one resource you've never had the courage to tap. It's always easier to hate than to forgive, isn't it? I think you've said enough, Parry said. The decision regarding Bella's exile was unanimous. That was 2 years ago, Thales said. He stood up, flinging his flexi across the table. We need Bella, whether you like it or not. If we all die out here, it won't be Janus that kills us. Svetlana had regained some scant measure of calm by the time her wanderings took her to the buried laboratory where Wang Zhanmin spent his days and nights. She heard faint Chinese music as she neared the lab. It was on the outskirts of Crabtree, connected to the rest of the community by one ice-walled tunnel and a single superconducting power line as thick as her forearm. The line was glued to the inner surface of the ice tunnel with gobs of geckoflex. Placing her palm next to it, she swore she felt her hand tingle. 1/10 of all the power generated for Crabtree passed along the line. She knocked politely and stooped into the icy cold of the kettle-shaped room. For all the energy at his disposal, Wang wasted none of it on his own comfort. The only concession was a speaker glued high up on one wall, out of which poured a constant tinny medley of 20-year-old Chinese pop songs. Svetlana shivered and zipped her coat tighter. Her breath gusted before her in a white flourish. She could still feel the embarrassment on her face, reddened by the cold. "I've brought you a present," she said, raising her voice above a screeching girl group. He turned from one of his desks, his face lost behind an improbable arrangement of magnifying lenses and improvised HUD readouts, lashed together with solder and day-glow duct tape. He reached up with fur-gloved hands and tugged off the homemade apparatus. He wore a red woolen cap, like one of Parry's aquatics. His hair erupted in messy black coils from underneath it, tumbling over his ears and brow. A pale green medical smock covered at least 5 layers of puffed insulation. His feet vanished into huge boots, ripped from an irreparable spacesuit. He still looked too young and earnest for her. She had nothing against Wang, but it terrified her that so much depended upon him. Wang turned down the music. A gift, he echoed. Don't get too excited. She held up the limp thing for his inspection. I heard your flexi died. Yes, he said distractedly, as if he had not considered the matter for some while. Yes, it did die. Is that for me? If anyone needs one, it's you. Coming closer, he took the flexi from her and held it in his gloved hands. They don't like the cold in here, he said. Not much we can do about that. If you spared a bit of warmth for yourself. I can't, he said. The experiments run best when they're cold. If I heated the room, it would cost me even more power to cool them down selectively. He stiffened the flexi, touched it with one finger so that it lit up with shipnet options, and then placed it gently on a clear spot on the nearest desk, amidst his equipment and notes. It's better this way. He looked up at her. How many do we have left now? Flexies, I don't remember. 160, something like that. There were more than 200 when we landed, weren't there? That means 40 have died since our arrival. They're not meant to last forever, Svetlana said. All the same, I am no computer specialist, but if more of them die, that will not be to our immediate advantage, will it? Not exactly, no. ShipNet was a distributed system, spread amongst the processing nodes of the Flexies. Already there had been a measurable degradation in the speed and accuracy of certain ShipNet queries. The remaining Flexies were compensating for the loss of the other units by hoarding more and more data within each of them, but this was only possible because of a reallocation of BioWare processor functions. Within 6 months, Saul Regis said, the degradation would become obvious even to casual users. Within a year, large parts of ShipNet simply wouldn't work at all. I'll do my best to look after this one, Wang said, caressing the thing as if it had genuine sentience. Perhaps if I sleep with it, use it as my pillow. Just use it, Svetlana said. If it dies, we'll find you another one. If you can get the vat running, it will be worth the sacrifice. I am sorry that I have not made better progress, Wang said, turning to face the vat. I was overconfident. I shouldn't have promised so much. You promised nothing, Wang. You just said you'd do your best to help us. That was all we could ever have asked of you. More than we had any right to ask. The forge vat sat in the middle of the room, resting on four welded legs. It was a fat red cylinder as large as a small lander, rising almost to the plasticized ice of the ceiling. Its lid had the concave curve of a pagoda. In one side was a small circular door, copiously hinged and armored, surrounded by readout ports, valves, and input sockets. Ribbed power lines plunged up from the floor into the vat's flanged base. It drew power and control commands from the consoles arranged around it, most of which had been salvaged from the avionics of the Shenzhou 5 before it melted its way into the ice cap, lost forever. Unlike Wang, whose limbs had healed well enough under Axford's care, the vat retained evidence of the damage it had sustained during the Shenzhou 5's crash. The red paint was bright and new on one side, where extensive patch repairs had been made. They had all done their best, including Wang, but attempting to fix a forge vat using rockhopper's tools was like trying to repair a cuckoo clock with an axe. They would keep trying, all the same. When we last spoke, Svetlana began, I thought I might have something to show you. Well, I was right, I suppose. He bent over the desk, picked up a pair of luminous plastic tweezers and fished around in a tray brimming with aquamarine fluid. The tweezers bit on something. With great care, Wang lifted them from the tray. Draped around their lower extremities was something that looked like milky seaweed or overcooked translucent noodles. I kept this because it was the most progress I had made to date. Svetlana looked at the fibrous white mass. What was it? It was meant to be paper, Wang said. Paper is a rather simple test subject for a forge vat. If you can't do paper... He shook his head, not needing to say more. At least it's a kind of solid, Svetlana offered. Yes, at least I made a kind of solid, and it is white. I suppose that has to count as progress. Svetlana looked back at the humming cylinder of the forge vat with an irrational resentment. All it did was drink power from Crabtree like a greedy baby and vomit out shapeless white pulp, when what they wanted was hard machinery, flexies, foodstuff, miles of superconductive cabling. It's progress, she said, swallowing her frustration and disappointment. No doubt about it. I can't give you any more power, Wang, but if there's anything else you need, people, resources, you know I'll always see what can be done. He returned the white mass to its bath and then wiped the tweezers clean with a sterile rag. I have power enough for now. More hands would only get in the way. He looked at her helplessly. I just need time and patience.
Time and patience, she echoed.
Except there isn't any time, is there? That's what you came to tell me.
No, there's plenty of time, she said,
knowing that he was working as hard as anyone on the moon. I came to give you the flexi, and to see how you're holding up. He studied the gift again, as if some trick were involved. Someone must have been using this one until now. No one has died, have they?
No, she said. No one has died. Nick Thale decided he could live without a flexi for now.
Oh, Wang said, looking down.
It was his choice, Svetlana said.
Yes, of course it was. Wang pulled his cap straight and reached for his headset, adjusting one of the stalk-mounted lenses, and prepared to lower it down over his face again.
If it is all right with you, I will continue trying to make paper.
You'll let me know as soon as you get anywhere?
You'll be the first person I call, he said,
scraping the headset down over his woolen cap.
Wang, Svetlana said.
Yes?
No matter what happens in the future, I want to thank you for what you did.
She stopped. That was all she had intended to say, but now that the words were out, something more seemed to be needed.
You didn't have to join us. You could have tried to make it back home.
I wouldn't have succeeded, Wang said.
You were a national hero, she told him. They'd have found a way to bring you back.
Perhaps.
But you knew we needed you more, after all we'd done to you. You still put that aside and gave us this gift.
There was a degree of self-interest. If I was going to strand myself on Janus,
I don't want to hear it, she said, holding up one hand. What you did was still a brave and selfless act, a beautiful thing.
He said nothing, just returned to his experiments. She stooped out of the room and waited for the music to start again. But by the time she reached the end of the corridor, all she could hear was the ruminative humming of the forge vat.